They had taken breakfast and completed the rest of the loading before the sun had fully dispersed the last of the night's chill. With a single stroke of his trek whip, Small Boy, the huge head driver, gave the signal to begin inspanning the oxen. This formidable instrument was a bamboo pole 22 feet in length, with a whip thong even longer. Without leaving his seat on the wagon or removing his clay pipe from his mouth, Small Boy could kill a fly on the rump of the lead ox in his team with the tapered forelash of kudu hide and not disturb a hair on the beast's back. Now, as he cracked the long whip with a report like a double-shotted pistol that could be heard a mile away across the plain, the lead boys ran to yoke the oxen in pairs and bring them in from the felt where they had been grazing. They drove them in with shouted insults and well-aimed pebbles. "Come, Scotland, you snake with 22 fathers and only one mother. Hey, Squint Eye, look this way or you'll fetch another stone. Wake up, lizard, you lazy skellum. Move along, Blackheart, don't try any of your tricks today." Pair after pair, the beasts were linked into the span. Then the leaders, the strongest and most tractable animals, were led to their places. Small Boy fired his great whip again, and without apparent strain, the oxen walked away, and the heavily loaded wagon rolled smoothly after them. At intervals of a few hundred paces, the other three wagons fell into caravan behind the leader. They maintained the wide spacing to avoid the dust raised by the hoofs of the leading oxen and the iron-rimmed wheels of the vehicles they pulled. Behind the wagons followed a loose herd of horses, spare oxen, milk cows, and sheep and goats for slaughter. Although they spread out to graze, they were kept in a loose formation and brought along at a leisurely pace by four herd boys. None of these lads was older than 13 or younger than 10. They were some of the orphans Sarah had gathered over the years, and who had pleaded to be allowed to join in the great adventure with Somoya, whom they revered. At their heels ran a motley pack of mongrel hounds, who had earned their keep by hunting and finding wounded game or stray animals. Soon only one small dog-cart remained in the encampment below the Baboon's Head kopje. But it was packed, and the horses were grazing nearby, ready to take Tom and Sarah back to High Weald. The family were reluctant to part. They drew out the last hour together, drinking a final mug of coffee around the smouldering fire, remembering all the things they had forgotten to say over the last few days, and repeating all those that had been said many times already. Tom had kept one of the most serious matters to the last. Now he fetched a mariner's tarpaulin chart case from the dog-cart and came back to sit beside Jim again. He opened the flat case and drew out a chart. "This is a copy of a chart I've been drawing up over the past 15 years. I've kept the original, and this is the only copy. It's a valuable document," he told Jim. "I will keep it safe," his son promised. Tom spread the sheet of heavy parchment on the ground in front of them and placed small stones on each corner to hold it down in the light morning breeze. Jim studied the finely drawn and coloured topography of the South Continent. "I had no idea, Father, that you were a talented artist." His father looked mildly uncomfortable and glanced at Sarah. "Well," he drawled, "I had a little help." "You are too modest, Tom," Sarah smiled. "You did all the supervision."
"Of course," Tom chuckled. "That was the difficult part."
Then he was serious again.
"The outline of the coast is accurate, more accurate than any other map I have seen. Your Uncle Dorian and I made the observations as we sailed and traded along both the western and eastern coastlines over the last 20 years. You've been on one of these voyages with me, Jim, so you'll remember these places." He named them as he pointed them out. "On the west coast, the Bay of Whales and New Devon Harbour." "I named it for the old country. On the east coast, this is Frank's Lagoon, where your great-grandfather buried the treasure he captured from the Dutch galleon, the Staanvastigheid. It's a fine anchorage, guarded from the open sea by an entrance protected by rocky headlands. Here, much further north, is another great bay, which the Portuguese call Nativity Bay, or Natal."
"But you don't have godowns built at these ports, Father," Jim interjected. "I know that they are desolate, deserted places, all of them."
"You're right, of course, Jim, but one of our schooners calls in at these places every 6 months or so, depending on the season and the winds. The natives know that we come regularly, and they wait for us there with hides, gum arabic, ivory, and other goods to trade.
Jim nodded. Tom went on.
Because you've already been there, you'll recognize any of those places on the coast when you reach it. You know where the maelstones are.
These were large, brightly painted flat stones set at prominent places on shore under which visiting sailors could leave letters in waterproof tarpaulin packets to be found by other ships and carried on to the person to whom they were addressed.
If you leave a letter there, you know that I or your uncle will find it in time. We also will leave them for you, on the off chance.
Or I could wait there for the next visit of one of your ships.
Yes, Jim, you could do that. But make sure it's not a VOC ship that you meet. By now, Governor van der Witten will have a large bounty on your head, and Louisa's too.
They all looked serious as they considered the predicament in which the young couple now stood.
Tom went on quickly to cover the pause. Before you reach the coast, however, you will have to cross hundreds, even thousands of leagues of virtually unexplored wilderness.
Tom spread his big scarred hand across the map.
Just look what lies ahead of your wagons. It's an opportunity I've been hankering for all my life. This place where we are sitting now is as far into the interior as I have ever been able to travel.
You have nobody to blame for that but yourself, Thomas Courtney, Sarah told him.
I never stopped you, but you were always too busy making money.
And now it's too late. I'm getting old and fat, Tom put on a lugubrious expression.
But Jim here is going in my place.
He stared longingly at the map, then lifted his gaze across the plain to where the wagon train was rolling away in its own yellow dust cloud, and murmured,
"Oh, lucky devil, you're going to see places never before looked upon by civilized eyes."
Then he returned his attention to the map.
"Over the years I've sought out every man, black, white, and yellow, who was ever reputed to have travelled beyond the borders of the Cape Colony. I questioned them exhaustively. When Dorian and I went ashore on our trading expeditions, we interrogated the natives we traded with. I have written everything that I ever learned from these sources onto this map. I have spelled the names as they sounded in my ear. Here, in the margins and on the reverse side, I have made notes of every story and legend I was told, the names of the different tribes, their villages, kings and chiefs. Then I have tried to mark in the rivers, lakes and waterholes, but there was no way of telling the distances between them and their compass bearings from each other. You, Bucket, Zama, and small boy, between you speak a dozen or so native dialects. You will be able to hire guides and translators as you travel on and come in contact with new and unknown tribes.
Tom folded the map again and placed it back with reverential care in the tarpaulin case. He handed it to Jim.
Guard it well, my boy. It'll guide you on your journey.
Then he went back to the dogcart and brought out a hard leather case. He opened it and showed Jim what it contained.
"I would have liked you to have one of those newfangled chronometers that Harrison in London has so recently perfected, so that you could more accurately determine your latitude and longitude as you travel, but I have never even laid eyes on one, and they do say that even if you find one, they cost £500 each. The same goes for one of John Hadley's reflecting quadrants. But here are my trusty old compass and octant. They belong to your grandfather, but you know well how to use them. And with this copy of the Admiralty tables, you will always be pretty sure at least of your latitude any time you can see the sun. You should be able to navigate to any of the places I have marked on the chart."
Jim took the leather case from his father, opened it and lifted out the beautiful, complex instrument. It was of Italian manufacture. On top was the brass ring from which it could be suspended to establish its own level, then the rotating brass rings lovingly engraved with star charts, circles of latitude and a marginal circle of hours. The alidade, or diametral rule, which served as a sunsight, could pick up the sun's shadow and throw it across the coinciding circles of time and latitude. Jim fondled it, and then looked up at his father. "I shall never be able to repay you for all these wonderful gifts and for all you have done for me. I do not deserve such love and generosity."
"Let your mother and me be the judge of that," Tom said gruffly. "And now we must start for home."
He called to the two servants, who were returning to the colony with them.
They ran to inspan the draft horses to the dogcart and to saddle Tom's big bay gelding. Up on Drumfire and Trueheart, Jim and Louisa rode beside the dogcart for almost a league, taking this last chance to repeat their farewells. When at last they knew they should go no further if they wanted to catch up with their own wagons before sunset, they lingered and watched the dogcart dwindling across the dusty veldt. "He's coming back," Louisa exclaimed, as she spotted Tom returning at a gallop. He reined in beside them again. "Listen to me, Jim, my lad. Don't you forget to keep a journal. I want you to record all your navigational notes. Don't forget the names of the native chiefs and their towns. Keep a lookout for any goods we might be able to trade with them in future."
"Yes, father. We have spoken about this already," Jim reminded him.
And the gold pans," Tom went on.
"I will pan the sands of every riverbed we cross," Jim laughed.
"I won't forget." "You remind him, Louisa. He's a scatterbrain, the son of mine. I don't know where he gets it from. That must be his mother."
"I promise, Mr. Courtney," Louisa nodded seriously.
Tom turned back to Jim. "James Archibald, you look after this young lady. She's obviously a sensible girl, and much too good for you."
At last, Tom left them and rode off after the dogcart, turning in the saddle every few minutes to wave back at them. They saw him rejoin the distant cart, and then suddenly Jim exclaimed,
"Name of the devil! I forgot to send my respects and farewells to Mansur and Uncle Dorian. Come on!"
They galloped in pursuit of the cart. When they caught up with it, they all dismounted and embraced again.
"This time we really are leaving," Jim said at last, but his father rode back with them a mile before he could bring himself to let them go, and he waved them out of sight.
The wagons had long ago disappeared into the distance, but the tracks of their iron-rimmed wheels were scored into the earth and as easy to follow as a signposted road. As the two of them rode along it, the herds of springbuck were driven ahead of them like flocks of sheep, the smaller herds mingling with those ahead until the land seemed to seethe and the grass was hidden beneath this living sea. Other larger wild animals became part of this tide of life. Dark troops of gnu pranced and cavorted, shaking their shaggy manes, arching their necks like thoroughbreds, and kicking their hind legs to the sky as they chased each other in circles. Squadrons of quagga galloped away in ranks, barking like packs of hounds. These wild horses of the Cape, striped like the zebra, except for their plain brown legs, were so numerous that the Cape burghers killed them in thousands for their hides. They sewed them into grain bags and left the carcasses for the vultures and the hyenas. Louisa looked upon this host with amazement.
"I have never seen such a marvellous sight," she cried.
"In this land we are blessed with such multitudes that no man need stint himself or put up his gun until his arms are too exhausted to lift it," Jim agreed. "I know of one great hunter who lives in the colony. He destroyed 300 head of game in a single day, and rode four horses to a standstill to achieve it."
"What a feat that was!" Jim shook his head in admiration.
The campfires guided them to the lagered wagons in the last mile of darkness, where Zama had the black iron kettle boiling and coffee beans freshly ground in the mortar.